Good evening. It's nice to see that we still have a few people left at the end of the day. And actually, we're going to be talking about Water Quality 101 and the comparison of practicing public health nurses and senior BSN students' water knowledge and attitudes. And we do not have anything to disclose. So here are a couple of sayings in relationship to water, and you can read them both, but it's just that really water has been important throughout our lifetime. And in the United States, our water quality is not all that great. I think sometimes we think it is because we get it out of the faucet, but there's over 316 contaminants. And out of those, 202 have no safety standards. They're unregulated. And some of the sources of the contaminants include 97 agricultural pollutants, 204 industrial chemicals, 86 contaminants that are linked to sprawl and urban areas, and over 42 pollutants that are the byproducts of the water treatment processes that we sort of forget about sometimes. So just the fact that we have water that's treated ends up with pollutants. And this just shows the regulated and the unregulated contaminants that we have where our drinking water actually comes from. And since 2004, at least 131 million Americans received tap water that was polluted with unregulated contaminants. And this just sort of shows you the 316 and the 202. And this is all chemicals, and this is the unregulated chemicals. And so when you really think about what we drink, it's amazing to realize how polluted our water truly is. And so how does our water become contaminated? The U.S. Geological Survey sort of demonstrated that air pollution is part of it. And then we have a lot of problems with how does it actually occur. Part of it is through air pollution, and then also we have wastewater runoff, especially from the urban areas, and then also we have a lot of agricultural runoff, and all of that goes either into our streams or seeps into our groundwater. So the definition of water quality, it's a term that we use to describe the chemical, physical, and biological characteristics of water, and it's usually in respect to its suitability for a particular purpose, like drinking water. So the background of our study, in 2008, there were 11 California public water systems that were actually cited for not complying with the new arsenic standards. And some of the Central San Joaquin Valley wells where we live have very high levels of actually naturally occurring arsenic. And then in 2006, the EPA finally reduced the maximum contaminant level for arsenic in our drinking water from 50 to 10 micrograms per liter. And some of you may not realize the health effects, especially of arsenic. There's a higher incidence of type 2 diabetes, a higher incidence of cardiovascular disease, peripheral vascular disease, hematologic and neurological disorders, renal disease, different types of cancers, developmental anomalies, and fetal death, and then methemoglobinemia, or the blue baby syndrome. And also, especially in our area, it's most often found only in bottle-fed infants, especially those areas that have high nitrates in the water. And when you look at the cases that there are, there's usually only around 2,000 cases worldwide in the last 25 years. So whenever we do have a baby with this, it means that there's actually some problems. Also, pregnancy complications, including things like anemia, preeclampsia, premature birth, possible neurotube defects, and then different types of cancers. And we really need to do a lot more research because we don't know whether the health effects of the nitrates actually leads to diabetes or if it's protective for things like cardiovascular disease and gastroenteritis. And where we live, we find that definitely diabetes and cardiovascular disease are rampant in our communities. So one of the things that we found in our local water quality that Kern County, Kings County, and Tulare County are the top 40 most polluted communities in the United States, not only for nitrates, but also the top 40 for arsenic, which sort of makes us both very unhappy. And then also, according to the California 2007 Compliance Report of Public Water Systems, in Kern County, we had 16 violations for arsenic, 6 violations for nitrates, and then Kings County, even though it only shows one violation, you'll see in my next slide where that's something's not quite right. We have some misreporting. And then in Tulare County, there are over 8 violations related to arsenic, but over 161 violations in relationship to nitrates. And then in Kings County, we have this one community called Kettleman City, which is a very poor community of approximately 1,500 people. And it's surrounded by a lot of agriculture, and it's bordered by Highway 41 and near I-5. And then in 2008, there were 4 babies that were born with birth defects. And over the last 3 years, there were 10 babies that were born with birth defects, including things like cleft palates, heart problems, and even infant deaths. And one of the things about Kettleman City, it's in an area where it's actually a waste dumping site, and it's the largest toxic waste site west of the Mississippi. And this last year, over 400 tons of hazardous waste was actually trucked in last year. And that's why we believe that there's a lot of problems in this one community especially. And they do have elevated levels of arsenic in their water wells there. So we had 2 research questions that we asked. And the first one was, how much do public health nurses know about common drinking water contaminants and the serious health risks that they pose? And then in comparison, how much do senior BSN students know about the common drinking water contaminants and the serious health risks that they pose? And so we had really 2 studies. In our first study, we looked at the public health nurses in 3 county public health departments in the Central California area, and then we surveyed them in 2 different ways. First, we looked at the knowledge of their county's drinking water contaminants. Did they know anything about the adverse health effects that can result from the different exposures? And did they know any of the signs and symptoms that might require additional investigation? Then we also looked at the attitudes and behaviors of the public health nurses in relationship to education and of their clients regarding the sources of their drinking water, and also along with any collaborative efforts with the other public health professionals to ensure safe drinking water. And then in our second part of our study, we looked at senior BSN students at Cal State Bakersfield, and they were asked to participate in an online survey. And they were asked about the knowledge of their county's drinking water contaminants, what did they know about the adverse health effects that can result from exposure to things like arsenic and nitrates, and the signs and symptoms that might require additional investigation. And then now Dr. Rector will talk to you about the water quality tool and the end of our study.
Okay, well, given the literature we were looking at, we developed just a survey tool, a simple survey tool. We asked some questions about demographics, age, and education, and that sort of stuff. Whether or not they'd had some specialized training in environmental health, because we thought that was important to understand, and where they got it. For instance, did they have college courses? Was it an in-service? Did they take workshops? And had they had personal experience with environmental health issues or worked with clients who had had experiences? We wanted to know, did they recognize if there were problems with their county's drinking water? Also, we asked some questions, what were the main sources of the drinking water? If they had a well, was it tested? Because we're in a rural area, so there are quite a few private wells, and there's not a lot of stringent rules for testing. Bottled water fluoridation, and then the effects of arsenic was the main thing we were interested in, but also nitrates, and then we have lots of pesticides, and then what interventions I might know about. So in the first phase, we got IRB approval, and then we got the three health departments to give us written approval, and we either did the surveys in one of two ways. We either attended a staff meeting and did a paper-pencil survey, or we went through the public health supervisors or administrators to email invite them to participate in an online SurveyMonkey. And of course, it was all anonymous. With the students, it was just simply an invitation to participate in the SurveyMonkey. For all graduating students, there were 81 total. They didn't all participate, but we had IRB approval for that as well. So if you're looking at the demographics, more public health nurses, because it was a larger pool, participated. But both of them were largely female. The public health nurse sample was a little older, 41 to 60, the majority, and 20 to 30 for the students. They both said they had some specialized training in environmental health. The public health nurses, it was a larger amount. Obviously, they're older and they've had more experience. But over half said that they'd had some kind of an in-service. And that's not uncommon because public health departments do provide in-services on pesticide exposure and on various different things. But almost a quarter of the bachelor students said that they'd had some specialized training, and over half listed a college course, but we're kind of wondering if they misunderstood. We said not your public health nursing course, but we're wondering if some of them didn't include that. Anyway, it was kind of interesting to see that about equal numbers could recognize problems in their drinking water. So they either, this was on a Likert scale, 1 to 5, and it was either yes, there are problems, or yes, some problems. As far as environmental health, more public health nurses reported more personal problems that they had experienced and more clients that they had worked with, percentage-wise, than the BSNs, which is not unexpected. And this is the effects of arsenic in water, and it lists the different things. Hopefully you can read them. They're very small. I'm sorry. As far as the public health nurses, they got 5 of them out of the 8. And I'm trying to read them from here, which is really difficult to do. Sorry. Okay. Developmental anomalies, fetal loss, and hematologic disorders, cancers, and the neurologic ones. The BSNs pretty much had the similar results, except they missed the hematologic. There were some responses in all of the categories, but for the most part. As far as knowledge of signs and symptoms of pesticide and other ag contaminant exposures, it was kind of equal. Half or a little over half of both groups said they had no knowledge at all. But if you'll notice the purple area in the top right on the left-hand side, the public health nurses, they did feel like they had, you know, some knowledge, probably due to the fact that they have done over the last 20 years from various different agencies at the state level, kind of workshops that they go around and do in services talking about pesticide exposure, usually related to more skin and lung and that kind of thing, but they may have had also some stuff relating to water. Health effects of nitrates in the water. This was sort of interesting to us because you notice that about half, again, of the public health nurses said they had no knowledge, but look at the BSN students. They did feel like they'd had some knowledge, a good portion of them, almost half. As far as interventions, if there were nitrate exposures, again, the BSNs had a larger number of saying, yes, they had some knowledge of this, whereas you see the majority of the public health nurses felt like they had no knowledge. So in conclusion, demographically, the public health nurses were older. They reported more environmental health training. Both groups were similar on reporting water quality problems. Experiencing environmental health problems, either personally or with clients, the bachelor students had about 75% of the experience that the public health nurses reported. And if you look at the health effects of nitrates with a cutoff of more than 40% positive responses, public health nurses could pick out 5 of the 8. The ones they missed were peripheral and cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes, which is interesting because those are really high in our area. The BSNs only got 4 out of the 8, as I showed you earlier, but they also missed the hematologic disorders. So knowledge of signs and symptoms of the health effects of pesticides and ag contaminants. Almost 30% of the BSNs had no knowledge. Almost 14% of the PHNs had no knowledge. For nitrates in their drinking water, the knowledge of those effects, almost half of the public health nurses said they had no knowledge of that, whereas over half of the BSNs had some knowledge. Thank you. But what we found out was kind of interesting in talking to the public health instructors, that they had some articles on nitrate exposure and interventions, and that they had some discussion board postings on this in the public health nursing class that they had just completed probably 6 months before the survey. So they had fresh information in their minds on this. And it was great that they included this because it isn't always something that's part of even public health to any great degree. So knowledge of interventions if nitrates are found, 64% of the PHNs reported no knowledge, and but about 14% of the BSNs felt that they were knowledgeable. We corrected these slides and they're still showing up strange. Sorry, we corrected them twice. Okay, if you look at the Gallup poll in 2009, the U.S. public rated water as the number one environmental concern. So it really is an important topic, and it is something that's part of our everyday lives. Chronic childhood diseases have been linked to toxic chemical exposures, and those are increasing, and in one study that I read, the cost is estimated to be around $55 billion annually. So it's a big cost factor as well as, the illnesses and the problems with that. Public health knowledge, nursing knowledge of water quality and safety in the communities is really important in protecting the public's health. Many times public health nurses are very well versed in water safety as it relates to, contamination with the E. coli or with other things like that, and they're very good at that kind of stuff, or in disasters, understanding about the importance of potable water and all that. But understanding this component is something that was sort of new to them. And they can promote client health through health education with their clients about water quality and safety, and also working to refer them to sanitarians when it's possible. So implications for nursing education, to include content on water quality. And we think it's really important to talk about local contaminants, to have students actually look up, like on ToxMap or some of these other sites, and see what are the pollutants that are in the air, to look at what the water problems are in their particular area, because it makes them more real, not just a general thing about, oh yeah, there are contaminants. But my family's actually drinking this water that could have this. And then to encourage the students to seek information about the common pollutants in their area, water, soil, and air. Consider nursing courses where the content could be integrated, like maternal child health and adult med surge, and to provide resources beyond the classroom that they can go look up at websites and share it with their neighbors and their family. So other authors have recommended that environmental health is really minimized and not often included in nursing curricula, that it does need to be given greater emphasis, and that using case studies and site-specific examples are really important. Both public health nurses and registered nurses could benefit from, more education and in-services that's readily available, especially relating to water quality and common pollutants. So to find out what could be in your tap water, here are websites that you can look up to see what your community is like. It's kind of eye-opening. We had no idea until we got into this. It kind of started with an interest in just look at this arsenic thing. And I had said to Kathy, yeah, I've been teaching in Kings County for years and they've had arsenic in their wells. They can't, it's just naturally there. And they don't seem too concerned about it. But when we started looking at what really happens, I'm going to click on through, so here's the references. But the main reason to really consider why it's so important is our kids and our grandkids and the water and the, the environment that we leave them. Anyway, thanks very much.
Anybody who has a question, feel free for any of the speakers. Yes. The question is whether other disciplines are involved in the project in Nicaragua.
Our university has actually held a health service trip for many years now, and we also have a, branch of Engineers Without Borders, So we started first going down to this community with the health service trip, but or this general area with the health service trip. And then Engineers Without Borders got involved, and they were actually the first to go to this particular community. We've been building wind turbines down in that area, actually, or our engineers have for a while now. So I think there are three in the general area of the community at this point. And our health service trip is interdisciplinary, so it's not necessarily just nursing and pre-med students, although it's the majority are nursing and pre-med students, but we've had education students go down there, do teaching stuff. We've also had other majors, such as Spanish majors, and so on and so forth.
And the teacher and me. Since we added the latitude and longitude component, and since Catherine, right around the time she was graduating, we added geography. So we have geographers working with us, engineers, education to some degree, but that's kind of been outsourced because we don't have a health education major at the university currently. So that's something that if we move in that direction as a university in our current strategic planning, I hope to bring in, but right now I'm working with people from Texas State on that aspect of it. So yes to answer. Yes. Oh, stay. Catherine is excellent at answering all the questions. It is an undergraduate research project, and in the participatory mindset, I generally make them do everything.
I really had a question about the Spanish part. Mm-hmm.
Catherine is fluent.
Okay, can I fluent then in Spanish? Because that was my concern, was how much of a barrier is it to you when you go down to do something like that? And also, do they use different terminology in their Spanish as far as looking at health conditions maybe that we don't usually use when we learn typical Spanish?
I will repeat the question. the questions were involving Spanish as a limitation, maybe different medical terminology, healthcare terminology that may be used in Nicaragua versus the U.S., and how is that translated? Do you want to?
Well, you can speak to the limitation part first.
Well, the limitation, actually, I can speak to, because really it is un poquito español where I'm concerned. But I guess what I found is that there's so much. Well, I'll take a step back. French was my language of choice as in high school and college, and because the languages are very similar, I can read Spanish. I just, when it comes to speaking, I'm somewhat limited. We work with, and I may be stepping into what you were going to say, but we work with translators from the community, and so everything that we do is translated into Spanish and then back translated into English for verification. And so that helps as well. Medical terminology, the beauty of it is it's Latin-based. And so much of it translates well, being in its Latin roots.
The other thing, too, is...
I want the mic.
Okay. So I went down there for the first time as a sophomore. And at that point, I wouldn't have necessarily considered myself fluent. I ended up spending the next semester in Mexico and kind of solidified my Spanish there. And then I went back to Nicaragua several times with this trip. I think I went 5 times altogether over 3 years. And it was difficult at first to switch over to the Nicaraguan dialect, because even though most of the strictly medical terminology is, as she said, Latin-based, and so therefore very easily translated. Nicaraguans have different words for different things, so they had a completely different word for knee, for example, than I had learned. But, you know, that's something that they can point to. You know, you just point to your knee, and then I can say my word for knee, and they're like, yeah, like, you didn't get that from what I just said. And so medical, I found that generally, even when words don't translate directly dialect-wise, because I did learn Mexican Spanish, I didn't learn Nicaraguan Spanish, you know, so there are some words that are different, but they still know the Mexican dialect words for the most part. So I can say those, and then they'll understand me and agree or disagree if I'm wrong in my interpretation. And I found that through just, you know, using the general practices that we use with patients of a different background generally, if we say the story back to them and it doesn't sound, it's not what they want to hear, it's not what they were trying to say, they'll tell you, oh, that's not what I meant. And so you can figure out even more about if you're translating directly or not.
Okay, so then you're going to do the socio-drama, is that correct?
We have been doing them, yes.
And so is it the people themselves doing them?
Yes. Yep, we actually left it completely open to the community as to how they wanted to present on our discussions. When we very first time we started talking with them, and we wanted to know, we'd like you guys, we'd split them into groups, and so we wanted to know, well, how do you want to tell the entire group or tell the entire community what we've been talking about here, because we think it's important. And they said, well, let's do sociodramas, or I've written a poem. And so, and they found that that was definitely the easiest and best way to relate those ideas, especially because the oral tradition in Nicaragua is very strong, yes. They have a phrase there, actually, that every Nicaraguan is a poet. And it's kind of true. So, yeah.
Thank you. My question to the last two speakers, when you talked about that arsenic was common or normal for that area?
In some parts.
And do you have a normal treatment that brings it down to a more usable level? Or is there an acceptable level?
Yes.
The question was, in some areas with the arsenic levels being naturally high, and are there things that they do for that? That's why they're out of compliance, because they're working on some of those things. And my understanding of that is not great. But it's not every place through the entire county, but in some areas, for instance, of Kings County, and I was surprised, because I live in Tulare County, I was surprised to see that there were some arsenic wells there. So, but yeah, 10 micrograms per liter, it had been dropped from 50, wasn't it? Yeah. And that's why that report was issued, and there were so many wells within this area that were out of compliance. So.
Can you tell, like, when the wells have the higher levels of arsenic, that there are higher incidences of?
I don't know that anyone has looked at that, because I think this is a cumulative effect, because everything that I've read about arsenic exposure is that this happens over a long period of time. It's not like a, you know, but if you're born and raised there and you're drinking that water all the time, and that's
bathing in it.
Right. And the state health department is investigating those cases in Kettleman City. I mean, they have people there working on trying to find out, is there a connection? So that's going to be interesting to see what they. It's such a small area and it's such a small number, and that's why those are always hard, you know, to prove. But I mean, that made the LA Times, and you know, so people are watching that.
And there's also a small city up by Lake Isabella that's very high.
Right.
Yeah.
County, yeah.
And that's very high in arsenic, and is actually one of the, I think it's in the top 15 of the United States. So they are trying to work on it. A lot of times, what they'll tell people is to go ahead and use either bottled water or use some kind of filter until they can go ahead and improve those systems. But they really need to improve the systems, because some of them actually serve large populations, and especially like in Kettleman City, they've really had a lot of problems, and it's actually one of the largest dump areas, and they're trying to get them to stop it, but that's partly how that county actually makes money.
They make money off that, yeah.
So, anyway.
Next year you'll have a disclosure from Aquafina.
Yeah. We're not recommending anyone particular.
No, actually,
or from Brita or any of that.
Actually, in a lot of our research, it was interesting that bottled water isn't necessarily that great for you.
Right.
Many of it is not, yeah. So
actually, they recommend that you use some kind of filter. So.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks.
Question for the first speaker. My question is, as the students complete their project within their three clinical courses for the DMP, right? What kind of rollover then do you see out of that into direction that they go with their capstone projects.
The question is they're doing these projects while they're students, and how does that roll into their capstone? And what the students can tell you is better than I can. What I teach them, no matter what agency we're working with, what I teach them is a method. And that method then can be applied to their area of expertise. And I have doctoral students who have expertise in policy, nurse-family partnership, HIV, STIs. I mean, it just goes on and on. The people that are coming back to school now actually have many years of public health nursing experience. They're nurse practitioners. I can't pull any wool over their eyes, okay? So I have to actually teach them methods, and those methods are actually part of the foundation. They start with nursing theory, then we get into the frameworks, and then we look at the relationships between these theories. One of them I like is one that I saw earlier today that he just breezed through, and I'm saying, don't breeze through that. The socio-ecologic model is so important. And, you know, and of course the nursing wheel, public health nursing wheel is another one we use. We look at systems approach. But then the other thing is that I'm also teaching them technical skills. So the technical skills are extrapolated into the reports that they have to do when they are on their own. And I will brag on my graduate students that have graduated. They're heads of health departments. They're directors of nursing at state level. I mean, as soon as they graduate, they're snatched up. So I'm just real pleased. And many of them, because they can go through with their portfolio for the DNP, they are able to demonstrate that they are capable in many of these leadership positions. Even if they didn't work in leadership before, their portfolio is so strong, and they have these documents like what I showed you to show. And in this particular class, they did 4 projects like that before they did their DNP capstone. So they were a busy group, and I'm very proud of them as a group, and obviously they're doing well. So did that answer your question?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Okay.
Any questions? Okay, thank you for your question, and thanks to our great speaker.